20-25 stations, which is, you know, essentially kind of like a, you know, a regional radio gathering in its own right.
We only have about a minute left. There's still time to register. Is there also still time for people to propose strategy sessions that they might want to be involved with?
Yeah, we're going to leave it, you know, a little bit open. We have two or three that we're working on specifically, but we have like five or six rooms. So we're even going to go, you know, up until that moment, people can propose a breakout session. Like, I want to talk about this. Like, okay, you can go in that room. Workshops are closed. Like, we have more than we can actually schedule in now, and the deadline passed October 1st. But people can still email us and propose strategy sessions, breakout sessions.
Great. Well, that's just about all the time we have. We've been talking with Tim Rice, organizer of the Cascade Media Convergence. Thanks, Tim.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
KBOO Portland. Up next is KPFA's From the Archives. First, a few messages for you.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Nosh for Nonviolence fundraiser on Thursday, October 22nd from 5 p.m. until midnight at participating Portland area restaurants. Nosh for Nonviolence is a collaborative fundraiser for two local domestic violence intervention agencies, the Portland Women's Crisis Line and West Women and Children's Shelter. Again, that's Nosh for Nonviolence fundraiser on Thursday, October 22nd from 5 p.m. until midnight. You can find the list of participating Portland area restaurants at kboo.fm. on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to present an evening of music and dialogue on the climate and jobs crisis Saturday, October 10th at 6:30 p.m. Joe Yulin is a labor leader who will discuss the urgency and the climate crisis and the response that must be made in carbon neutral work, education, and more. Again, that's an evening of music and dialogue on the climate and job crisis, Saturday, October 10th, 6:30 p.m. at the AFL-CIO Hall at 3645 Southeast 32nd Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
12 months of bribery, 12 months of lies. Cops in the village to truncheon your pride.
Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives, and welcome to From the Vault, our weekly series that takes the history out of the oldest and largest collections of public radio programming in the United States and puts it back on the radio. This morning, September 24th, 2015, I was tuned into the address Pope Francis gave to a joint session of Congress. I heard the pontiff invoke the name of Dorothy Day, the American co-founder of the Catholic Workers Movement. Today on From the Vault, we feature the voice of Dorothy Day from a 1960 KPFA interview, and we will hear from Blaisbone Payne, director of the Office of the Americas, who knew her. Dorothy Day was born in 1897 and died in 1980 at the age of 83. She was an activist who worked for such social causes as pacifism and women's suffrage through the prism of the Catholic Church. Intrigued by the Catholic faith for years, Dorothy Day converted in 1927. In 1933, she co-founded the Catholic Worker, a newspaper promoting Catholic teachings that became very successful and spawned the Catholic Worker movement, which tackled issues of social justice guided by its religious principles. Day also helped establish special homes to help those in need. For more about Dorothy Day's life, visit catholicworker.org. Today, September 24th, Pope Francis called her out as one of the four great Americans, along with President Abraham Lincoln, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and Thomas Merton. And now, the interview with Dorothy Day, conducted by Eugene Boyle, broadcast on KPFA in Berkeley, California, May 3rd, 1960. This is the first time, to our knowledge, of it being broadcast anywhere since then.
We are very privileged this afternoon, friends, to have in our studio a Dorothy Day, who is instrumental in founding the Catholic Worker Movement. Today, this movement is still in existence and publishes the Catholic Worker, a newspaper. So I'm going to start off by asking Dorothy if she wouldn't mind just saying something about herself, perhaps about the foundation of this movement some time ago with Peter Morin.
Well, the paper started in the middle of the Depression, you know, 1933. And it was started, actually, by a French peasant by the name of Peter Morin. His name was spelled M-A-U-R-I-N, but he Americanized it and called it Morin, so as not to be confused with an Irishman by the name of Moran. But he had very definite principles and a program of action, and he was so compelling a personality and so great a teacher and had such a background of history that he very soon gathered around him a group of students, and he more or less impelled people to have a sense of personal responsibility and get busy. So when he talked about our personal responsibility as opposed to state responsibility, calling himself an anarchist and quoting not only St. Francis of Assisi but also Kropotkin, he stressed this to such an extent that we soon found ourselves involved in a program of action that's gone on up to the present time.
Dorothy, may I interrupt and ask you where this began? I don't think we told the audience that.
It began in New York City.
New York City.
Down on the east side in an old tenement house. And our first office was an old barber shop. And we went from there. We took the paper ourselves that we began to publish, called The Catholic Worker, an eight-page tabloid. We took it out on the streets and we sold it ourselves. We took it to meetings and constantly brought it to areas where there was conflict, whether it was a strike or whether it was a demonstration of some kind. We sent it out to schools and colleges. We spread it in that way, and it built up a circulation of now 65,000.
My. Specifically, what is the philosophy or the theology behind the Catholic Worker?
Well, Peter Morin had been a Christian brother over in France and had been a teacher, and he felt a vocation to the worker. And he came to this country and worked all over Canada and the United States as a unskilled laborer. He worked in lumber camps and mines, steel mills, and so on, at the rough kind of work, and traveled from one end of the United States and Canada to the other. And his philosophy, well, first of all, he talked about the need for a philosophy of work, and he talked about that long before anybody else talked about it. And he talked also of the sense of personal responsibility needing to be developed. For instance, during the Depression, he made fun of the proletariat and said what we should do is to fire the bosses, that one should find one's work and do it regardless of paychecks, that we should not think in terms of selling our labor over a counter like a commodity. What he was really talking about was mutual aid and the ownership by the worker of his means of production and cooperation. And certainly when he met the priests from Nova Scotia who had built up the cooperative movement up there, why, they used to spend the whole night talking, he and Father Tompkins.
I see. It
was so much a part of his whole philosophy, the whole idea of regional groups. And there was one principle that I have a quotation here from Pope Pius the 11th, which illustrates what Peter Morin was talking about. Pius XI said that it is an injustice and a grave evil and a disturbance of right order for a larger and higher association to arrogate to itself functions which can be performed efficiently by smaller and lower societies. This is a fundamental principle of social philosophy, unshaken and unchangeable. And it was on the basis of this fundamental principle of social philosophy that Peter talked about our responsibility to perform the works of mercy rather than the state.
I see. In other words, this is the principle of subsidiarity, as it's sometimes called.
Yes.
Yes, in having the...
And it was his opposition to the welfare state.
I see. So in other words, his philosophy of life was more or less to return to the people functions which they themselves could perform, return to the workers, for example, services and so on that they could do. Was that
what you'd say? Yes, whether they were unions, credit unions, cooperatives.
Well, what would you say today is the, has been the effect of Peter Morin? After all, we don't measure these things exactly in vast numbers, but we're out here in the West Coast. We hear of the Catholic worker and the Catholic worker movement, but I have to say that we hear about it only through rumbles. We do see the paper here and there, but we would like to know what kind of effect this has had and is having at the present time, as we say, in the New York area where it was founded.
We have a very large circulation in California, and I would say that next to New York and Massachusetts, the largest circulation is in the state of California.
Is there any one particular part of California where you would have the heaviest circulation, Dorothy?
No, it's scattered.
No, scattered. Mm-hmm.
But I should first say that Peter Morin's social philosophy and his theology, which was a very simple return to the Sermon on the Mount, resulted in what he called houses of hospitality, so that we soon found ourselves working in not a settlement house or a mission or anything of that sort, but our newspaper office turned into a center for mutual aid. We feed still about 250 men a meal. It results in a whole group of people living together, nobody getting any salary, but everything being spent for the care of those who come to us. So we have right now about 8 apartments. We have 2 houses on the beach on Staten Island. We have a farm on Staten Island. And people come to us, and we try to respond immediately to their need without referring them, without turning them over to other agencies. I don't know how we do manage. There never seems to be more than we can handle. The house gets terribly crowded. The place is packed at mealtime so that you can scarcely get in or out of it. But thank God they've been in off the street during a terrible winter such as we've had. We have these 8 small apartments that are slum apartments. You can put up a few people, from 2 to 4 people in each place. The staff, which is made up of about 10, 12 people, can spread their responsibility. One of the editors, Charles Butterworth, a graduate of Harvard Law School, lives right over in the Bowery with all the overflow. We take over a number of rooms at the Salvation Army, for instance, and we've sort of moved in on them there, one floor.
I see. Well, do you have anything like this outside of the New York area?
Oh, yes. There's houses in Detroit. There are 2 houses there, one for men and one for women, which are Catholic worker houses.
I see. Well,
one in Rochester, one in Chicago.
Was there ever one founded in this area,
yes.
In the Bay Area?
Yes, there was a house of hospitality here, and there was one in Oakland. The one in Oakland was run by Brother Antoninus.
Yes, Bill Everson,
yes.
That's right, yes.
He has written some poems about the poor, the conditions of the poor. But Peter Morin went much further, of course, than house of hospitality and just the works of mercy. What he went on to was a long-range program of action which would, if we started and really got anywhere, it would overturn our present agricultural system. It would put the associated farmers out of business. It would rescue migrant workers from one end of the country to the other. We would be building up what Peter Morin called farming communes.
I see.
And he used to talk to us a great deal about the kibbutzim of Israel. We have friends there, by the way, and the Catholic worker even goes to some members of these kibbutzim. If that's the way you pronounce it, I'm never quite sure. And the whole thing we feel is absolutely on the cards. The rest of the world is going this way, and if we don't handle our tremendous problems of agriculture and industry along these decentralist lines, if we don't think in terms of a long-range program, these things will come about by force if the time is given us. But you see the rest of the world going along these lines of collectivization. Peter Morin always used to say that there's a communism, Christian communism, and a Christian capitalism. There can be a balance between the two.
Between both of them.
Yes.
Yes, well, I imagine quite frequently, since your movement is sometimes described as a radical movement, and in the true sense of that word, getting back to the root, shall we say, of things, I imagine many times it's thrown at you, well, this is rather unrealistic. I mean, it would require practically an annihilation of our present society. It would require almost checking the way society is going today in order to bring such things about here in the United States. I imagine now, Dorothy, that this kind of objection is thrown up to you.
It's that is certainly thrown up to us constantly. But one of the things that rather irritates me is when we are constantly called romantic agrarians. And here our dear friend John Court, who is also a Harvard graduate, mm-hmm. who worked with us for quite a few years and was very much interested in labor and is now an organizer and an official in the newspaper guild, he always is referring to us, even up to the last month, as the romantic agrarians, and constantly acting as though we were advocating a return to the small farm, the mm-hmm. family-sized farm, which we are not at all.
Mm-hmm.
Peter Morin talked about farming communes, and that's what he was interested in. And if the communal aspects of the church have resulted in such tremendous success on the part of religious orders, if they have been able to accomplish such a tremendous amount, if even materially it has been so tremendously successful, to the extent that over and over again there has been an overturn of a taking over of monastic property, a constant, you might say, a pruning, a constant persecution, and some deserved, of course, as well as undeserved. And if there is this success in the long history of the Church, and if over and over again places like the Benedictine Monte Cassino in Italy is overthrown and torn down and rebuilt over and over again, if you see this persisting tradition in the Church, you begin to think of Peter Morin as a prophet. You begin to think of him as someone who is suggesting for the family, for communities of the family, the same type of organization. Of course, people will always say human nature being what it is, man must have private property, and so on and so forth. Well, Adlai Stevenson and others have described some of the collectives over in Russia as places where there are 85% collective farms and the other 15% state farms.
Mm-hmm.
And on the collectives, there is home ownership. There is a few acres. There is the family cow. There is the family garden, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And quite aside from the use of force, which has brought this about, quite aside from the doing away with sections of the population in order to bring this about, I would say that we should look to a place like Israel where these things have been brought about voluntarily.
Mm-hmm.
There have been constant struggles, of course, but the desert has been made to bloom. Men have been brought to the land. Families have been building up a new way of living in this present day.
I see.
I think that's the only example that we can show of voluntary associations of men in these communes, except perhaps for India,
mm-hmm.
where Vinoba Bhave is advocating this redistribution of land and even of the holding land in common.
I see. And you feel, or of course, obviously, Peter Morin felt that such a thing was the only way to solve the very grave problems that we find in agriculture and in labor. There's no doubt that many of these things come up in California mm-hmm. today. No doubt you back east do hear rumbles once in a while of our problem, the migrant worker and
the Cicero. Oh, father, rumbles. Why, we have it right there with us.
All the time.
How do you suppose all the vegetables on those Seabrook farms are harvested except mm-hmm. by migrant workers?
Migrant workers,
there's
I
been
see.
Bloody strikes back there.
Mm-hmm.
There's such tremendous agricultural holdings that it takes thousands of migrant workers coming up from Florida all the way up the East Coast, all the way as far as Maine.
Mm-hmm.
All the fruit is harvested. No, mm-hmm. we have the same problem,
same
too.
Problem there, yes.
And they go from one end of the country to the other, through Ohio and through Michigan. It's a constant problem. I've seen so much of it. That's why I think that these things should be studied I'd say, though, that Peter had a sort of a double attitude towards it. I'd like to bring this out because Peter was a profoundly spiritual person, and he thought practically as a peasant, and he thought in terms of these solutions. He was constantly urging students to study history and to try to bring about changes, to see where we have gone off, where we have made mistakes, and by studying the past to make the present different in order that the future will be different. But at the same time, he was the kind of man that spent his hour at Mass in the morning. He was a daily communicant. He would go and spend hours sitting in the presence of the Blessed Sacrament. He laid a great stress on the primacy of the spiritual. And he talked to us about Charles de Foucault and his life in the Algerian desert and the living amongst the poor, living a life of voluntary poverty and manual labor, and this whole idea of presence, this whole idea of love of brother, showing your love for God by your love for your brother, not making attempts at conversion, not making attempts at teaching catechism, scripture, anything else under the sun.
But just living Christ, yes. Being Christ to these people.
Yes, but living Christ, putting on Christ, and putting off the old man. So Peter emphasized that, and he himself lived it. He lived always on Skid Rows. That's one of the reasons perhaps he was led a life of obscurity. Of course, he was invited to speak at many colleges and many seminaries throughout the country. We have a member of our staff now who is more or less the American peasant, Ammon Hennessy. He's the oldest member of our community. Most of the rest of the staff are in their 20s, early 30s. But Ammon Hennessy has lived a life of hard labor. We ran a series of articles of his on his life at hard labor, as he called it, down in Arizona and through New Mexico, Denver, around Denver on these huge dairy farms. But he has lived this life. He's lived the life of a poor man, for one thing, because he is the absolutist, the pacifist. And he chose poverty because then how little there would be to tax. And he chose to work by the day so that he would not have to pay income taxes, 85% of which go for war. And he advocated this. He said, well, we must examine our consciences along these lines.
Well, we'll get to that point in a minute. I would just like to tie up this a little bit about the Catholic worker and Peter Morin. You have talked so appealingly about him. I wonder, has he left any written record of his thinking?
We have printed and reprinted his essays over and over again in the paper. I suppose we're the only newspaper that uses that kind of a technique of constant repetition, but they strike people with always with freshness. We've issued a whole volume of his writings called Catholic Radicalism, and it came out just before he died in 1949, which pleased him very much.
Dorothy, what is the address of your Catholic worker in New York City?
It's 39 Spring Street.
39 Spring Street.
We're in the heart of the Italian section, right in the center of town.
Yes.
Another book has been written about Peter Morin by Arthur Sheehan, one of the staff, and published by Doubleday. It's one of the subsidiaries of Doubleday. I don't know what it is.
I see.
The name of it exactly.
Has it been published recently, you say?
Within this last 6 months.
Last 6 months, I see.
It's probably a 350 book or something of that sort. We're hoping it'll come out in paper cover.
Yeah, as we all do. Well, so much for that. You have brought up a matter there that we would like to treat with you. There are certainly occasions when the Catholic worker, and specifically Dorothy Day, does make the newspapers out here, and that is in relation to the attitude of the Catholic worker group to war, specifically, of course, to taking part in air raid drills and so forth. Now, perhaps you might give us here some, well, your philosophy of pacifism. You see, it's frequently enough that that people feel that, you know, that a person cannot be, that the Catholic Church, in other words, cannot harbor within itself people who can hold and have pacifist not only tendencies, but actually pacifist principles. And I would like to present the audience, Dorothy, some ideas of yours along these lines.
Well, if you don't mind my going back to Peter, I would say that he began the whole thing by his emphasis as a Frenchman on man's freedom. And this emphasis he placed because he felt that this was God's greatest gift his free will, that man by his free choice would serve, would worship, would establish relations then with his fellow men too, mm-hmm. that he would show his love for God by his love for his fellows. And he carried it so completely into his own life that it resulted in his being a complete pacifist. He felt that we would never change anything by the use of force, that you could not preserve these principles of Christian of freedom, man's freedom, not just Christian freedom, but man's freedom in general, that the only way to do it was by the nonviolent resistance of a Gandhi. Mm-hmm. And Gandhi was recommended to us, I remember, in the very earliest year of our work by Jacques Maritain, who pointed out that in his book Freedom in the Modern World, he has a whole chapter on the purification of means mm-hmm. and of the Gandhian technique. Well, Peter stressed this always. These things should come about, he always said, all these changes by man's free choice. And all of our groups that grew up all over the country, sometimes there would be as many as 30 houses of hospitality and a dozen farms. But the whole principle was that no one should be given jobs in return for their bread, that man by his free choice would pick out things that he wanted to do and do it. So that would work out where one man would say, well, I can cook, and so he would take over. Men win their authority by their own sense of responsibility. The others accept it, because a man is worthy of respect and shows by his ability his leadership. So that around the Catholic Worker, for all these 27 years, there's been this anarchist point of view, you know, where one man said, we have no bosses around here, we're a group working together. And one Italian fellow said one day, I heard him say, well, my boss is the one that tells me when the bread runs out, and then I go on out and do the shopping. In other words, one may recognize an authority here or one there. Somebody has charge of the paper. Somebody has charge of the mailing. Someone has charge of the kitchen. But it's the kind of thing that people take upon themselves to do and show their responsibility. Man's freedom is always emphasized. Man is a creature of body and soul, made in the image and likeness of God. We are supposed to see Christ in him. Well, Peter always emphasized these things to the extent that nobody was ever asked to do a thing. Some people would sit around. One fellow used to sit around and say, I'm not going to do anything until I'm told to do it. I want a little organization around here. Mm-hmm. So that it was a principle on which people would fight. They would really try to work it out painfully. Well, of course, it was in relation to war, too. The same principles go for nations as go for individuals. One of the popes said, the same morality is demanded of nations as is demanded of individuals. And from the time the Catholic Worker started, we lived in a time of war. There was the Japanese-Chinese war, and I think the longshoremen right out here in San Francisco refused to ship scrap iron to Japan because it was going to be killing our Chinese brothers. Mm-hmm. There was the Ethiopian War. There was the Spanish Civil War, there was the Second World War, the Korean War, right now the Algerian War, and so on. So this is no new thing. It's nothing imposed upon the Catholic Worker point of view. It's something that grows out of our whole attitude. And, of course, Ammon Hennessy, being the absolutist and the extremist, we always call him an individualistic anarchist, whereas mm-hmm. Peter Morin was the communal anarchist and so on. But what Ammon stresses is the fact that we must not depend on numbers. We must not think of what the other fellow is going to do. We must follow our conscience mm-hmm. and do what we have to do. And in his case, it is to going to jail in the First World War before he became a Catholic, studying the scripture there because he was in solitary confinement for 9 months, and becoming a convert to the kind of Christianity that acknowledges no church, a Tolstoyan Christianity. Mm-hmm. And then little by little, through association with the Catholic Worker, he became a Catholic. He made a retreat at the Catholic Worker Farm in New York. Father Marion Casey, whom he always calls his anarchist priest, much to the confusion, perhaps, of other priests and to Father Casey himself very often. But Father Casey baptized him, and when he baptized him, He named him Ammon St. John the Baptist Hennessy. Of course, Ammon, it was an old Saint Ammon, father of the desert. Ammon is very much the father of the desert.
The way the voice of one crying in the wilderness is good.
Yes. Well, he's worked in the deserts. He has a great love for the Indians. He is probably visiting the Hopi Indians right now, who are very pacifist. Mm-hmm. He goes from city to city right now, talking about this personalist point of view. People always say to him, how many of there are you? And he says, oh, two or three. What difference does it make how many there are? And some of the rest of the group around the Catholic Worker will say, well, what is he talking about, two or three? After all, there's quite a number of us. But what he is pointing out is numbers don't count at all. Mm-hmm. What we have to do is to follow our conscience and do our own job. And that has led him into prison many times. And it led the rest of us into prison beginning 5 years ago. Because when they started this compulsory air raid drill, in the first place, we felt that it was part and parcel of psychological warfare. It was a military drill. And as pacifists, we felt we could not take part in a military drill. We are committed to the performance of the works of mercy. We would do everything we could to save life or to work in disaster areas and so on. But we did not see ourselves doing the utterly foolish thing of trying to take shelter under these huge skyscrapers of New York and the ridiculousness of it, all of us to be buried alive. There is no shelter for nuclear attacks. The Holy Father has called nuclear warfare suicide and massacre. Mm-hmm. He said suicide and massacre. The first words he uttered were against this tremendous arms race. He said the money should be spent for the poor. Mm-hmm. So we took these things out on the street with us. Of course, he hadn't said these things at the time we first went out 5 years ago. But Ammon Hennessy, when this demonstration was planned by the War Resisters League, the Quakers, the Fellowship of Reconciliation, the American Friends Service Committee, and all these groups, including the Catholic Worker, when we planned this demonstration, got out leaflets. Ours, I remember, held a quotation from Jacques Maritain, particularly one we gave out, about man's duty to follow his conscience and to make an impress on the thought of his day by coming out over principle. Well, Ammon proceeded to sit down and notify the civil defense authorities and the FBI and the chief of police and the mayor and everybody else, you know, just what we were doing. He said, this is the way Gandhi did things. Mm-hmm. He notified the authorities. He showed his respect for the authorities by notifying them. And so, of course, when we got there, they had the police wagons all waiting for us.
I see.
And I think many of them did not expect to be arrested. I think it was a great surprise to many members of the group. Ammon was always ready for it, of course. He felt that he had achieved a victory when the government considered the affair dangerous enough, influencing public opinion enough to decide to jail the participants. So we were all taken off to prison. We only spent, however, 24 hours in jail that year, and we finally all of us received a suspended sentence. But the next year we got 3 days, and the year after that we got 30 days, and the next year we got a suspended sentence, and last year we served 15 days. We got a 10-day sentence, but we'd spent 5 days in prison waiting trial because we wouldn't give bail. And the air raid drill comes up again this year, mm-hmm. and I'll be back in New York just in time for it.
Oh, you're not going to be out here, Dorothy.
No. Uh-huh. It's not compulsory out here. It would be my duty to return. After all, you share with others this mm-hmm. experience, and also, incidentally, while you're in prison, you're performing the works of mercy. Mm-hmm. You're visiting the prisoner in a very real sense.
You are listening to a 1960 interview with American journalist, social activist, Christian socialist, devout Catholic convert, and co-founder of the Catholic Workers Movement, Dorothy Day, on From the Vault Radio. Pope Francis called her name out as one of the four great Americans, along with Martin Luther King Jr., Abraham Lincoln, and Thomas Merton. For a copy of this program, visit us online at fromthevaultradio.org or call us in the archives at 1-800-735-0230. And now back to Dorothy Day, interviewed by Eugene Boyle at KPFA in Berkeley, California, 1960.
You're certainly sharing their poverty. You're sharing their complete destitution.
But, of course, the practical man, of course, hears this, and very naturally, of course, this is, I admit, a very an objection you've hit many, many times. Well, why all this trouble about all of this thing? I mean, it's true. We could see this approach when it came to, our government's use of atomic bombs and all this kind of thing. But why in this type of thing that is apparently being organized for the protection of people in case of atomic attack? Now, you have referred to it as part of the psychological war. Perhaps you could just explain that a little more fully.
One year, there was a young physics instructor from Purdue who came and demonstrated because he said there is no defense, that this is a deception, a deceit of the public, mm-hmm. that there is this such a law is against common sense. So we're being more realistic than all the people who are putting on the show.
I see.
I think over and over again, it's felt to be a rather nonsensical performance and a very expensive one, mm-hmm. of course.
It seems that many people are leaning toward the pacifist position. However, I don't think very many are going quite as far as the Catholic Worker does. Today, I think we do find, men like Father Strautmann, whom I think we could type as, a relative pacifist. In other words, a man who does not declare that all war is out, as you do, or should we say ineffective, but who claims that because of the type of instruments we have today of warfare, the atomic bomb and so forth, that it just cannot be held. But there are still some, as I say, even though the leanings are more and more toward this, who claim that this kind of thing, pacifism of any kind, is not quite square with the public doctrine of the Church. How do you counteract this kind of objection, Dorothy?
Well, the theologians have been wrangling about this, and there isn't public doctrine of the Church on this subject. There has been certain principles laid down by St. Thomas Aquinas mm-hmm. on the conditions for a just war.
Well, I refer now, I'll be very specific with you, I'll refer to an article by John Courtney Murray mm-hmm. That appeared, first of all, in Theological Studies. Later it was condensed into the, fully in the Catholic mind, condensed in Theology Digest. And this is one of his statements. In fact, he even used in a footnote Father Strautmann's book as an example of the absolute pacifist, and it was in that footnote that he stated that he did not see how this squared. And he was using, of course, the principles, basically the principles, ultimately the principles of St. Thomas, but he was using Pius XII most of the time in his article. Do you remember that article, Dorothy?
I know mm-hmm. his writings, though, of course.
Yes.
Well, I am not going to set myself up to argue with so distinguished a person as Father Murray, but I can only point out that far more than Strautmann have made pronouncements about these
well,
things.
Well, have you read Father Bede Griffiths, for example?
Well, Bede Griffiths was one that I was going to mention, mm-hmm. and he talks about how we are to work. And he quotes always the Catholic Worker that it's mm-hmm. through groups such as ours that there will mm-hmm. be ill growth mm-hmm. in the whole climate and mm-hmm. and temper of peace. But then there's Archbishop Roberts over here in Spokane,
yes.
the Archbishop of Bombay.
His article, by the way, and perhaps you might mention this, but I wouldn't like to pass it by, an article by Archbishop Roberts and also by Bede Griffiths appeared in a little booklet put out in England called Morals and Missiles.
I hope you can get that at the Sarah Bookshop because it's splendid. It has articles
well,
by
I got it there myself, and I hope that they do order more copies because I think it is well for people to read through this and to see the various positions. But pardon me, Dorothy, go right ahead with Archbishop Roberts.
Well, he's just one of a whole group. There's another, beside this little pamphlet, Morals and Missiles, which contains all these essays, there's also a Pax Bulletin published over there in England. They're far more active along these lines than we are in this country.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps because they're a little closer to reality, huh?
Well, we're the two great warring powers, mm-hmm. Russia and the United States. Mm-hmm. We're equally aggressive. Mm-hmm. We are trying to outdo each other, you might say.
Of course, the English also experienced the devastation of, total bombing and warfare.
Of course.
And
we haven't.
They know it's complete waste and everything else.
Do you remember Monsignor Lally, the editor of the Boston Pilot?
I certainly do, Father. Uh-huh. I met him. Monsignor Lally was out here for the UNESCO meeting, I'd say 2 years ago, and I met Monsignor Lally on that occasion.
Do you remember how he said in the Boston Pilot, the diocesan paper, that we have committed a mortal sin as a nation, and it is unrepented? As a nation, we are in a state of mortal sin. That's a terrible statement for the editor of a diocesan paper to come out with.
And what was he referring to there, Dorothy?
To Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Nagasaki, yes. Yes, I think Father Murray brings this out very well, too. He speaks of the morass in which we had gotten, morally speaking. His whole idea in his article is to show that the Catholic doctrine on war was never brought out, and because it was not, there was no public opinion formed so that people would be able to have some kind of reaction against such a thing as that. And he doesn't go quite so far. I mean, I suppose that's a journalistic emphasis if Monsignor Lally is using. Father Murray does not quite go that far, but he says, in effect, the very same thing. I mean, he says the horrors, not only the horrors, but, shall we say, the disgrace which such things were and still are, if they are unrepentant. And in many ways, this is very true.
There's one statement in the New Testament which is rather terrifying in the 25th chapter of St. Matthew, that just because we're ignorant of having committed a sin doesn't excuse us. I mean, in a way, that's a strange thing to most, I think. It must be with full knowledge, according to theology. But after all, our Lord, when they said to our Lord, when did we do these things, not feed you, clothe you, shelter you, visit you in prison, and so on? And he said, inasmuch as you did not do it unto the least of these, my brethren, you did not do it unto me. And he did not excuse their ignorance when they questioned him. Someone pointed out that war was the opposite of the works of mercy, that you don't feed the hungry or clothe the naked or shelter the harborless, as you were commanded to do. You go ahead and do exactly the opposite. You devastate the land.
Yes, well, I think that most of these men thinking today, I mean, I fully believe that the moral theologian looks toward the day when he can tear out these pages on the conditions of the just war out of the theology book. But as most of them say, claiming, of course, to be realistic, we haven't yet arrived at that day, and really that our, shall we say, moral principles here are a kind of accommodation to a reality that just cannot be completely erased. In other words, man hasn't completely gotten out of the state of barbarism as yet and hasn't completely absorbed the principles of Christianity. We are working toward this, but at the same time, until we get that far, it seems, and this is, I'm just giving the ideas that seem to be presented by these men, until we get that far, it is still necessary for us, and Father Murray claims this is what Pius XII did try to bring out, to delimit the conditions under which a war can be fought at the present time. Now, in other words, I would say in relation to you that they would claim, in other words, that you are, shall we say, out of due time or ahead of your time. Now, this is, I know, no doubt, these the kind of things have also been presented to you before.
Well, even in that moral order, those conditions have not been fulfilled. And always after the event, it is recognized that it's gone far beyond the bounds of the limited war. When there was a call made that the war not be extended by Pius XII, when the call was made that the war be not be brought into the schoolroom, when a call was made for cities of refuge, all of these things were brought out. Who ever paid any attention to them?
Mm-hmm. Nobody. Mm-hmm.
And to limit warfare now, the conditions for a just war are impossible of fulfillment.
Mm-hmm.
Impossible. So even along those lines, it seems to me, everybody's a pacifist between wars.
Yes, I agree with that. Everybody is between wars. It's only when we actually get in the war, then, of course, that we have to justify our own particular action in regard to this.
I'd like to point out that there is an evolution of peace, and that in France now the seminaries are half empty because seminarians or priests are all drafted to fight. And they fight, not just for chaplains. Right?
Yeah, of course, for many years.
Yes, and in other countries too. But here in the United States and in England, why, the man of God is not expected to bear arms. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, it would be inconceivable. Mm-hmm. You can imagine the kind of horror, the idea of the priest behind the machine gun, and so mm-hmm. on. Mm-hmm. Yes. We have a friend who went crazy in a Trappist monastery, as a matter of fact, because he was a poor little brother. He'd worked with us in one of our houses. They put him to work as a baker up in the Trappist. And they were having some spiritual reading at a meal or whenever they do have their spiritual reading, all about a saintly soldier who, while he killed off the Germans, was reciting prayers for their soul salvation. Mm-hmm. One by one, he was praying for them as he shot mm-hmm. them down. And this poor brother just went out of his mind, began mm-hmm. to weep and cry, mm-hmm. rushed to the abbot, fell on his knees, and said, "Why should the body of Christ rend itself in this way?" Quoting mm-hmm. one of the early fathers. Mm-hmm. And he had quite a breakdown. He recovered from it. He's all right now. But how do these things set fire to your enemy? Flamethrowers, obliteration bombing. How can it possibly be justified? Mm-hmm. And what has it achieved? Mm-hmm. Our allies now are our enemies. Our allies in the last war are now our enemies. And our enemies are now our allies. And so... it's such madness. I speak as a woman now, of course.
Yes, of course.
So
well,
completely impractical, unrealistic. You speak about being realistic. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that it's far more realistic to be mm-hmm. a pacifist than not to be a pacifist.
Yes, well, I'm glad you mentioned that fact. And I have often brought this out in talks mm-hmm. On occasion now that I remember a famous phrase that we had, one of the ways that Horace, going back a long way, described wars in his poems was always bella matribus detestata, wars detested by mothers and by women. And I do feel many times when we're trying to convince people of spreading the love of Christ in the world today, which we do, in other words, trying to convince them that there are people who will never hear of Christ except from their lips, who will never feel his love except through the love and concern that they give, that, in fact, people who will never see God or see Christ except in the good example of these Christians, these godlike people, I often bring out the fact that I think today that it will be the woman who will bring man back to reality, particularly in regard to the means used to settle disagreements between nations.
Well, Father, it's hard for a woman to go around and talk about these things, and I would like to call attention to all the movements there are in the world today that are not women's movements at all. Gandhi, the impress he made on our time, Vinoba Bhave, who is still walking through the roads of India, mm-hmm. and there's a Benedictine priest walking with him, I hear.
Is
I'm delighted
right?
to hear that.
That's something I didn't
Father
know
Bede
that.
Griffiths in India.
Yes, would you mind just give a run, just a quick sentence for the people on that? I think that's something interesting. Perhaps someday I'll speak about it, but I've only read, of course, the articles I've seen in common we are written by Bede Griffiths concerning what he's doing there. But perhaps you know a little more. It doesn't have to be too long, Dorothy, maybe a word or two.
It was a matter of studying and... the tremendous spirituality of the people of India and living with the poor and living as holy men with them and adapting their way of life. Mm-hmm. I don't know too much about it either, and it's so small a movement anyway.
Yes, well, I think the idea is, of course, to adapt Christianity, the principles of Christianity, to the customs and traditions and to the spiritual life of the people that is already
yes.
present.
Yes.
To their, should we say, maybe not the objects of their spirituality, these, of course, we disagree with, but to their means and to their spirit of prayer, their sense of the presence of God, and so on.
Well, besides what happens in India, there's a community of Catholics in France, led by Lanza del Vasto. And then there's a community in Spain, led by a Father Llanos, a Jesuit. It's called El Ciervo, and it's a group of pacifists. Mm-hmm. And there are these little movements all over the world, you know. Mm-hmm. We're constantly hearing about them. The Little Brothers of Jesus, of Charles de Foucault, mm-hmm. the Little Sisters, Africa. Working and living with the poor. Mm-hmm. And then all the members of the Pax Group in England, mm-hmm. number of priests. Mm-hmm. It's a real movement throughout the world, it seems to me, amongst Catholics. And I think that just as we're pacifists in race war and class war, I think that we must be pacifists in all kinds of war.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being present here with us in KPFA. We thank you very much for the time that you've given and a very busy schedule out here in the West. Thank you once again Dorothy Day of the Catholic Worker.
And that was Pacifism and the Catholic Church, Dorothy Day, interviewed by Eugene Boyle, Berkeley, California, 1960. She died in 1980 at the age of 83. To contextualize our recording and the address before Congress by Pope Francis, September 24, 2015, I called to talk to Blaise Bompain, the director of the Office of the Americas in Los Angeles, California, which he co-founded with his wife Teresa in 1983. He works on human rights issues and identification of illegal and immoral aspects of United States government policy. Bompain served as a Mary Knoll priest in Guatemala and was assigned by the Cardinal of Central America as National Advisor to Centro Capacitación Social, a center for university and high school students working in the field with the indigenous people on matters of health, literacy, and labor organization. He was expelled from that country in 1967 in the midst of a revolution. Today, in addition to his work at the Office of the Americas, he's a veteran host of World Focus, heard on Pacifica Radio.
Hi, Brian. It was back when I was in Mary Knoll Seminary in the 50s. We had one of the great scripture scholars in the United States, Dr. John McConnell, and he mentioned in scripture class that perhaps the best example of Christianity at that time was the Catholic Worker Movement and what Dorothy Day was doing. And I think he was quite correct, and I think that's why the Pope selected that. Dorothy was a member of the Communist Party and had a conversion, and then wrote her book called The Long Loneliness. And hearing about her, we went down to the Bowery to the Catholic Worker Movement, spent some time there. Eamon Hennessy was there, and we stayed in touch with her. And even prior to going to Guatemala to my mission, when I returned from Guatemala, she was at the Catonsville trial, and she chided me for supporting Ernesto Cardenal and the Sandinista rebels, and I tried to explain to her that this was a community and self-defense, that it was not aggressive war, it was defensive. So we had, you know, a few differences on that, but the fact remains that she was a great soul, and I think the hierarchy at that time was fearful of her. Cardinal Spellman was like the U.S. Pope at that time, but he knew enough not to interfere with her work. I think the relationship between Cardinal Spellman and Dorothy Day is similar today to the Pope being Dorothy Day and the bishops, etc., being reticent to jump on his bandwagon. But that is not unusual in the life of the church. My final visit with Dorothy was up at La Paz, where I was, my family and I were living with Cesar Chavez, and she spent some time there, and we discussed nonviolence further, and we certainly had nothing but a reverence for her. And I'm glad that the Pope selected her. She have her picture on my wall here in my office. She was a great example of Christian who was in touch with the basic message of Jesus and was not did not allow bureaucracy to interfere with her practice. And she was doing what the Pope called for, feeding the hungry, giving drink to the thirsty, visiting the prisoners, taking care of the sick, dealing with those that had no clothes, those who fell through the cracks. And until people get that, they don't understand the message at all, because that's what it was about. It was about dealing with people who fall through the cracks. And it was about dealing with people who are in the wrong faith. Dorothy was very good about that, and so was Jesus. He praised the Samaritan, which was the wrong religion. He praised the Syrians and said that the Spirit was among Naaman the Syrian, and his local synagogue almost killed him. They tried to throw him over the cliff, you see, in Luke 4, because he continuously talked about those who did not fit, were not accepted, who were outcast, And that's what the Pope is doing today, and that's his pride and joy, is that he's in touch with the message. And the Pope is not the problem. The problem has been the institution, not so much the Pope. We're very happy about the Pope. We're not happy about the institution as it performs. She could be very severe in her approach. She had been through an awful lot in her life, and she was not a fundamentalist. I know the Pope today condemned fundamentalism. She was not a fundamentalist, but she was very much interested in the Word, in what the Gospel was about, and she practiced that throughout her long life, and her book, Long Loneliness, is well worth reading, and I know that the recording will be of great value to the listeners as well.
So, Blaise, what thoughts and responses do you have to the Pope's address in Congress outside of the Dorothy Day's name being invoked with the other three, Martin Luther King, Abraham Lincoln, and Thomas Merton?
Well, I feel it was a very important message, and it differed greatly from so many of the other papal comments. I mean, he really spoke of the arms trade as something that had to be ended, which is so extremely important. And he rejected the religious bigotry, and he acknowledged the fact that fundamentalism in any religion is a very dangerous thing. He was not excluding his own. He was not excluding Roman Catholicism. And he wanted us to stop punishing immigrants and to help the refugee crisis, which I might say we caused. That crisis would not be there had it not been for 24 years of war in Iraq and also the long, endless war in Afghanistan, and now supporting the richest country in the world, Saudi Arabia, as it destroys the poorest country in the Arab world, Yemen. So he felt, and also he basically said that foreign policy cannot be guided by might makes right. He called on the Golden Rule, which is so international, that people should treat others the way they want to be treated. The Golden Rule is not surrounded by national boundaries, and he wanted to stop the global arms race right now. We have to ask ourselves, he said, why are deadly weapons being sold to those who plan to inflict untold suffering on individuals and society, leading to innocent blood? And he faced Congress, and in one of the most direct lines, he said, stop the arms trade. He also, rather than talking about abortion as such, he talked about ending the death penalty. Mm-hmm. This was extremely important, that he was talking about life, and that capital punishment and criminal justice policies that don't offer rehabilitation are not doing any good. So he called for a global abolition of the death penalty, and he praised the U.S. bishops for taking that stance. He said, I'm convinced this is the way, this way is the best, since every life is sacred. Every human person is endowed with inalienable dignity, and society can only benefit from the rehabilitation of those convicted of crimes. And then he talked about the key problem in the economy, which is that 1% of the people of the world, not U.S., 1% of the people on this globe earn more than $20,000 a year. That's an absolute failure of capitalism to achieve distributive justice. And he spoke about distributive justice. You can't just have 1% making enough to get by on, and have the rest of the people groveling in the dust. So many billions are earning, get a dollar a day maybe, or $2 or no dollars. And that's a sign of an absolute failure of an economic system. It simply is not working. And so we're proud of his statements. We know the problems within the institution, and they show up there. But we're proud of how he identified Thomas Merton as well, which is a very good person to identify. And he, of course, spoke of ending the U.S.-Cuban problem by saying, it's my duty to build bridges and to help men and women in any way possible to do the same. So he talked about resuming the path of dialogue, opening up new opportunities, that this requires courage, daring, which is not the same as irresponsibility. So I think it was an extremely important statement. One of the bishops down in Washington said, well, his message will be the same as all the popes that came before him. And that's simply not true. That's part of an old doctrine known as Semper Idem. The church is always the same. Well, it is not always the same, and the people speaking for it are not always the same. And he said things in this address that had not been said previously to the government of the United States. So we're very proud of that. We understand the problem areas. We know about the furor, about Junipero Serra. And once again, the problem there is entirely a problem of the institution. We can quote the papal bulls that were effective at the time of Junipero Serra, referring to these savages and referring to enslaving them. And so you might say that Junipero Serra was a company man, just as our people. We haven't improved today. Our chaplains in the military would give the troops the impression that God is on our side, which is certainly not. It's simply a falsehood.
And that was Blaise Bompain, director of the Office of the Americas and host of the radio show World Focus, heard on Pacifica Radio. For more information about Blaise, visit officeoftheamericas.org. And that does it for this week's From the Vault, responding to current events with historical perspective. From the Vault is produced by Brian DeShazer and Mark Torres, with help from the